This is the Wealthability for CPAs show. Better clients, better practice, better life. Here's Tom Wheelwright.
Welcome to the Wealthability show for CPAs, where we're always discovering how to get better clients, create a better practice, and end up with a better life. This is Tom Wheelwright, your host, founder, and CEO of the Wealthability Network. So failure is a part of business. I mean, a lot of us have really felt that the last couple of years. We failed maybe a little faster and a little more than we thought we'd like to, but it doesn't have to be a crippling part of business. So what we're going to learn today is we've got an expert. I like to say that Chris is an expert on failure. And I think that's a great expertise, Chris. I think that's awesome. Yeah, he wrote the book on failure, a very, very popular book called Meltdown. And we're going to look at how do we prevent from melting down? How do we prevent the big failures while maybe even embracing the small failures? So Chris Clearfield, very happy to have you on the show with us. And if you would just give us a little bit of your background.
Tom, I'm very excited to be here. You know, thank you for the invitation. And you're spot on. I mean, I am an expert on failure. Sometimes I feel like I'm too much of an expert on failure, if you know what I mean. My background. So I wrote a book called Meltdown. I have a co-author who's a sociology professor, and me, I'm kind of a sort of systems engineering sciencey guy. I started thinking very seriously about failure during the 2008 global financial crisis. I was at the time a derivatives trader. So I really had this front row seat to—
Oh, so you were actually part of that failure.
I was not, well, I mean, I was a, I mean, you're joking aside, like, yes, although not in that way, right? I was sort of a consumer of the failure like everybody else. I worked for a small firm that did equities and equity arbitrage. You know, we call them a high frequency trader nowadays. And you know, but at the time, I mean, it was really wild to look at a company like, you know, like Boney, like the Bank of New York, who essentially just like a lot of what they did was held safe assets and held assets that were, you know, in trust. And you would see a company like that, who is, you know, the kind of hallmark of stability, like making really drastic moves in their share price. And I mean, that was just a kind of sort of a shock. I think a lot of us had our some of our assumptions, simplifying assumptions about the world, disrupted pretty quickly. But that's the event that got me interested in kind of failure as a science, failure as a craft. And at the time, I was also learning to fly. So I'm a flight instructor. I teach people how to fly now. But at the time, I was just learning. And, you know, one of the things you don't want to do in an airplane is have a big failure. And so one of the ways that you work with that is by reading and trying to understand others' failures and others kind of what, you know, what you can learn from others. So I had these two worlds kind of converge. And I started really thinking about the role of complexity and the role of organizations to be able to be resilient in the face of complexity and disruption. And
yeah. So let me ask you about that, Chris. So,
yeah.
You know, we have a famous, you know, saying from Elon Musk saying that failure is an option. And, you know, we have, Thomas Edison, who said, "I didn't fail, you know, 9,999 times. I just practiced." Right. I mean, and I just need to get it right once. And this was, and so, and then of course we've got our, in my case, my grandkids, and they're constantly failing and getting up and failing and getting up. And that's how they learn, right? That's how little kids learn. So how do you distinguish between, if you would, a good, what makes a good failure versus a bad failure? Because, you know, when a kid, for example, falls down, scrapes his knees, gets up, my grandson says, "I'm good." That's a good failure because he's right. Learning from that without drastic consequences. But if he falls off a two-story building, this is not good. So
right.
Very different types of falling. So how do you distinguish? You just distinguish because of the, is it the type of failure? It is the magnitude of the failure, the frequency of the failure. How do you look at that?
We can start with two kind of higher level things, and then we can sort of poke around and drill down. But you highlighted one already, which is the consequence of a failure. And so one of the things that I think about, like when I'm working with, I work a lot with big companies who have, you know, big projects, high stakes things, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars kind of on the line. And one of the things that I always think about is how do we break this up into something that's manageable, where we are not going after a big monolithic change, for example, but where we are, you know, choosing one place to try and implement that and seeing what happens, getting people on board with us and doing experiments and seeing what happens. And so one thing is really you can kind of shape your landscape so that you can be in a territory where you're going to fail, but the consequences aren't dramatic, right? And getting comfortable with that, getting comfortable with that idea. I mean, Elon Musk, right? Amazon is another company that really, I think, has lots of challenges in their organizational culture, but really does celebrate this, you know, let's go for it. And then we're going to fail. And we're going to be okay with that. So that's kind of one thing. You think in terms of consequences and you think in terms of how do you go from this big monolithic consequence to, you know, really a series of experiments. But then the other thing, and I love that you framed this with kids, because I've got sort of three kiddos in my life and, you know, it's something that I think about a lot. And I, of course, you know, have people on my team and I see the way that they approach failure. And one of the things that happens is there's a social element to failure, right? So we don't like talking about failure in school, you know, over and over from kind of like, you know, fourth grade on, you're being given problems that have defined answers and your job is to find that answer. It's not to explore, it's to kind of come up with the quote unquote right answer. And I think that that whole system sets up this real social nature of failure that the best companies, the best organizations, the best cultures, they really work to overcome that, because that really is, at least in the West for most of us, that's the default stance, that our job as a leader is to find the answer. And actually it's not. Your job as a leader is to be curious and ask different questions and learn. And I think that there's a real kind of stark difference between cultures that are able to learn from failure and cultures that sort of try to suppress it, sweep it up.
Right. So the question is it a mistake or a failure, right? Because
Mr.
Fuller is famous for saying that a mistake is not a failure until not admitted. So as long as you
yes.
admit your mistake, it's not a failure, right?
Right.
Because you can learn from it. If you don't admit the failure, now, and if you don't admit the mistake, now that's a failure. That's a sin. I mean, that has higher consequences because you're not admitting it. So when you bring that, let's bring that to an organization. Now we're talking mostly with CPA firms and we're talking about, you know, people with 10 or 20 employees, maybe less. So how do you look at an organization and go, okay, what types of failures are we trying to avoid or mistakes are we trying to avoid? What kind of mistakes actually would we like to encourage?
That's such a good question. And, you know, I think one of the ways you can get, and this is something we talk about in the book, there's a technique called the pre-mortem. And it, you know, a post-mortem is you look back at something that went wrong and you figure out why it happened. And those are very good. And we do those a lot, retrospectives with my team and with other people I work with. But the chief limitation of the post-mortem is that the mistake has already happened or the failure has already happened, right? So a pre-mortem is a technique where you can say, okay, let's imagine it's 6 months from now, a year from now, and we've had a really high impact consequential failure with our clients and with our client base, or we've missed something that's of consequence. What were the things that we missed, or what led us to that failure? And it's a very subtle shift in language, but you can hear that I'm predicating this on there was a failure. Now, what were the causes? And what we know about the human brain is that actually helps us generate more creative, more specific possibilities. And so that's one thing I really encourage people to do, you know, both on kind of the macro level when they're thinking about their strategy for the business, but also on the level of thinking about, you know, we're going into, I mean, you know this better than I do, but we're about to go yet again into the busy season for CPAs, right? And so let's imagine it's, you know, April 16th and we've missed something big and important. What was the cause of that miss? What was the cause of that failure? So that's one thing to think about, to sort of, you know, in a preemptive way, try and get insights about your failure.
I like that. Instead of waiting until April 16th to do a postmortem, January 15th, you do that pre-mortem. I like that idea. We're actually, my CPA firm, I have a small CPA firm along with the network. And we are actually doing that second week in January. So glad to see that.
There you go.
We'll take that advice. We'll actually implement that. So one of the things that you talk about in your book is you talk about the dangers of complexity. So yes. Can you kind of explain what you mean by that? I mean, I have my own, the term I use is, there are certain people that complexify things.
Yes.
I hate that because I'm a simplifier by nature. But what are the dangers and where do you see that causes problems within the business systems?
Well, let's talk about it first on the very high, like on the big level. So, I talked a little bit about the financial crisis and about really starting to understand that complexity was one of the drivers of this failure on a systems level. And then what really shaped my path to sort of go into consulting and to become a service provider, to hang out my shingle was Deepwater Horizon blowing up, the big BP oil spill, and just realizing that reading about that accident, digging into the investigation reports and realizing kind of two things. One, that, gosh, this accident, different industry, different people, but it's the same as the financial crisis. It is this series of interactions and unintended, unanticipated consequence that led to this big failure. And the flip side of that thought was, you know, an oil and gas engineer on that rig who had spoken up and had the power to change that could have been the greatest environmentalist of the last 50 years that we never would have heard of, right? So really, I sort of saw at the same time both the complexity of the system and the ability for somebody to kind of intervene in it. So that's really at the macro level, right? Now, your listeners aren't running oil rigs, but, you know, when I think about the complexity of a business, one of the things that I suspect some of your listeners and some of the people in your network might do is say yes to every kind of client that comes across their door, right? And so now all of a sudden it's a big problem, right? So now you're in a situation where instead of being able to kind of pool your resources and improve and iterate and really tighten up your system, you're now in a situation where, you know, you're kind of saying, I'm open for everybody, and you're going to end up doing, you know, a tax return for somebody for $250, and you're going to end up, you know, doing bigger work for, you know, local businesses where you're charging them 20 grand a year or whatever it is, and you're giving them really valuable advice. And that is, it doesn't seem like it, but that's really an instance of complexity. That's an instance of, you can, none of those are bad options, right? But choosing both of them may not be the best.
That makes sense, because what you're not doing is you're not narrowing the field, which is what simplifies things, right? When you know,
right.
This is what I was telling some of our members a couple of weeks ago. When you narrow who your client is, you know exactly what their demographics are, their psychographics, you know who you want, you know that target audience. So I have a very, very specific target audience, and it begins with the price I charge, frankly. That's actually the starting point. And there are certain both demographics and psychographics. You know, for me, it's gotta be really interesting. It's gotta be really challenging. And they've got to be willing to learn. Okay.
Yes.
Because I don't want a client that just says, you go do it, because I'm not interested and I can't, I'm going to fail at that. So I'm really, really narrow in and that's why I only have a few clients, right? I have a few clients, but that few clients produces more income than most CPAs would ever consider making. And am I hearing that right? That's what you're saying is, look, narrow your focus, and you narrow the focus, it actually simplifies things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, if we can play with what you just said for a minute, I think there's a lot in there, because my suspicion is that that wasn't the philosophy you practiced on day one, and that you didn't even know who those clients were on day one. So can you just talk a little bit about the failures that you went through?
Absolutely.
And then I'm happy to share mine from a business context.
No, totally.
Too.
So when I was starting out, I had no business, because I actually was fired by a big firm, and that's what I said. Well, then I'm just going to start my firm, right?
Yeah.
And I was really good. I went from two clients to four clients in 9 months. So I doubled my business.
Totally.
But at that point, I'm supporting a wife and two kids, and you know, that's not enough to do it. I went out and bought a business, and then I just started taking on clients. Whoever showed up, I would take. I was just like everybody else, And we ended up actually having to sell one of our practices because it didn't fit. And it wasn't until we really understood who we were and narrowed. Actually, we didn't get the right clients coming to us. I always look at that law of attraction, right? Who are you attracting? And you're going to attract the people that you're focused on. And if you're focused on everybody, you're really attracting nobody.
Right.
And so it's much harder. I found it's much easier. I have to turn away clients now. Whereas in the beginning, I was accepting everybody. So now I accept a very narrow field of people and I have to turn people away. Back then I was accepting everybody and I was just desperate for clients.
Yeah.
Right. So it is really exactly like you say, the more scattered you are, the less successful you're going to be.
Well, and one thing I get curious about, and I have lots of moments of reflection on this in my own story. You know, you can talk about this on the level of the kind of tactics of the business, but I'm curious for you, what were the beliefs that you had to shift internally, or what were the beliefs that you shifted internally to be able to move through these different?
That's interesting because this is something that we work with our members a lot on, that a lot of this is personal development, and it's got to be,
yeah.
I'm okay with myself. Right. I'm okay with who I am. I'm okay. I'm confident in what I do. And I've never not been confident in what I do. I mean, I was with one of the big firms. I was in-house tax advisor for a Fortune 1000 company. I mean, I have a sterling resume. Okay. So that's from a technical standpoint, that's never been an issue for me.
Right.
But you still have that issue of, okay, am I deserving of this? Do I deserve to have this? Can I let this into my life? And, you know, then a couple of times, and maybe you can address this, I found I'd hit a ceiling,
yep.
Right? A bit of my own glass ceiling, right? And then it wasn't until there was more personal development to break through that glass ceiling. So it was always totally about me. It was never about the customer.
I think that's a beautiful way to say it. And, you know, one of the things that's embedded in that statement is just this idea of being responsible, right? Not feeling at the effect of and being responsible for your own, not just your own development, but the way you show up in your work. And, you know, for me, I'll just share a little bit of my journey. You know, so Deepwater Horizon blows up. I'm like, wow, I can help people with this, right? I see myself having a perspective that I don't see anybody else having in terms of really thinking about complexity at the center of this. Now that turns out to be a double-edged sword because most leaders, even in, you know, big complex organizations, don't wake up and think, oh, I have a complexity problem. They wake up and think, oh, you know, I need to change the way we do reliability over here, or, you know, how can we get this team to work better? And so it really took me years to shift from the thing that I was interested in to the thing that leaders, that I think, you know, the problem, the presenting problem as they see it. Now, I think the underlying problem is still often this piece of complexity, but that's been an interesting part of my journey, the humility to say, okay, like, sure, I'm onto something here and there's something important here. And I really do believe that as we're talking about, the lessons here are pretty universal in the world of business, but being able to kind of take a step back from my own, I don't want to say arrogance, but my own sort of sense of that I knew the right way to think about this and start to be receptive to the clients that were showing up and the messages that I was getting. And I remember, and then of course for me, this has been a not quite a decade long journey, which is still not that long in the arc of a lifetime.
It's been four decades for me, pal.
You're right. I'm just a kid. Exactly. And I see that, but you know, one of the things that happened for me was the pandemic happened. And that was this kind of, you know, real wake up moment that said, gosh, my whole philosophy in building my business has been to go after control, and I'm actually never going to be able to be in control. And so let me start to let that go. And that was a big personal development. I mean, still is, right? I'm always going to be working with that.
Well, that, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that CPAs have, because one of the things that CPAs love is they love control, because guess what? Numbers give you control.
Right.
All CPAs love numbers. And, you know, there's this sense of security and safety within a number, because we can jokingly say 2 + 2 is whatever you want it to be, but the reality is 2 + 2 is really 4, right?
Right.
So there's safety in that. There's safety in that assurance that I can control that part of my environment. The challenge is, like you say, is that when you shift from being the accountant to being the entrepreneur, which is really what we're working with all of our members on, is be the entrepreneur. You can hire accountants, right? So be the entrepreneur, because then what happens is now all of a sudden you realize I have no control, right? I mean, like March of 2020 hit.
Right.
And one of our businesses, all of a sudden, our sales dropped 80% in 1 week.
Right.
Whoa. Right. Now you see just how fast can I adapt to that? And then the other business, which is the CPA firm, we're going, it's not the business fault. It's actually the business all of a sudden was there, but we're there to serve our clients. And so, you know, what can we charge for, et cetera. So, you know, we're essential workers. We're working all the time, but it's not like we're getting paid for that work. Right. So I think you're right. I think that's one of the biggest upsets with the pandemic is people feel out of control, and it's a very unsettling thing. I think it's good for CPAs, because I think CPAs, we need to realize that we're not in control, and that it's the better way, if you really want to get in control, I know you talked about this some, is to really develop systems, right? So that you can get a reporting of what you need to manage. So how does systems, when you talk about system and you think about systems and you think about system failures versus system successes, how does that affect your level of control?
Right, because it's such a good question. And what I would say is, and this phrase is not in the book. One of our kind of readers and fans gave it to us as we did the book tour. I wish we had given it to us before. It's that the antidote to complexity isn't simplicity, it's transparency. And so it's great, right? This is a very smart guy, this guy. And so
I would just own it. You know, we call that R&D, rip off and duplicate, right?
Well, but there's really something there in the learning, right? And I think for me, what that goes back to is, you know, you don't want to overcomplexify things, right? You want things to be exactly as complex that you need them to be, but in whatever system you build, whether it is, you know, a kind of the way you ask people, the way you delegate tasks, or the way you ask people to do things, you need to just have a way to keep things transparent, to see work in progress, to see where it is. And what that gives you is the ability to improve and learn over time. So
practical suggestions for transparency.
Well, it really depends on the context you're working in. If you're thinking about work with a client in a financial context, what are the numbers that they really need to know? What are the numbers that they really need to care about? You know, I do this in my own business, thinking about, okay, there's this sort of hierarchy you can build over time, right? Like, all right, once I've got cash flow dialed in, right? Once I understand the amount of money in a bank account, then I want to understand, okay, what's coming up? How do I think about what's coming up next? And then once I've understood that, I want to think about, okay, well, you know, what is it I need to do to be able to expand in this way, to be able to scale in this way? And what are the resources that's going to take? And so it's kind of like you need just the right amount of transparency to meet people. You need to use transparency to drive insights rather than, you know, kind of gee whiz reporting, right? Gee whiz reporting is like, it's like the difference between answering your email and, you know, launching a new product, right? Launching a new product advances your business. You know, success or failure from the product, you're going to learn something. Answering your email every day is just a task that many of us use, myself included, to distract us from the work of moving towards uncertainty.
It's an avoidance technique for sure. Let me ask you about a very specific transparency item that I think is an issue for our listeners in a lot of cases, and that's price transparency. So one of the big challenges that CPAs have is most CPAs charge by the hour. So they can tell you what your hourly rate is, but telling you how much it's going to cost on the front end, I think is critical. I actually am a big fan of let's set the price on the front end. Here's how much that tax return is going to cost. And we will live as the CPA with the over or short.
We'll totally. Live,
okay. But we're going to give you a transparent price so you know exactly what you're going to pay for. And then there are no surprises. So how does that work into your idea of transparency being the antithesis of complexity?
Well, you know, I'll go back to what behavior does that drive for the CPAs, right? What behavior does that drive for the firm owners? And, you know, I work a lot with law firms and corporate legal departments. And so you've got the same kind of hourly billing, right? This exact same thing. And you know, the amount of, it does not add value to the system, right, is what I would say. And so when I think about, I mean, this is back to, do you take in everything that comes through your door, right? If you're willing to stake your name to a fixed price, right, that really frees you up to do two things. Frees you up to improve your systems and simplify them. And I mean, it frees you up to measure the, like, how, you know, your profit on a kind of given engagement. And it frees you up to think in terms of the value to the client rather than the cost that goes into something. And I'm sure that I'm not the first person to talk about value pricing to your audience. But I mean, just to go back to it, you know, when I'm working with Microsoft, an Etsy, and Netflix, we're talking about what's the value of this project to you? What is the value of this work? Because that's what's important. If it's not valuable to you, then not only is it not going to be worth the budget, it's also not going to be worth your time and attention. And so, you know, I think it's an interesting spin on it. I've never put these two things together, but when I think about transparency and pricing as you're bringing it up, like, what that actually does is that helps you drive simplicity into your system, because now you're actually thinking about your place in the value chain and kind of how that works.
Exactly. And I actually think it helps drive efficiency and effectiveness too, because
yes,
what it's saying is, I price this, I'm the one who has to live with this. I can't push this on. Again, you talk about avoidance with emails, right? I can't avoid the pricing issue and put it on the client's back. Rather,
right,
what I'm doing is I'm owning the pricing issue, and I'm saying, I will live with this. And you know what? I only have to live with it for a year. So you talk about fail small and quick, right?
Yes.
I only have to live with this pricing for 1 year. Next year, I can change my pricing. So, okay, for this tax return, it's X. Next year, it might be Y. No, that we're going to try this. And I think you can even be transparent as to, well, let's try it out and see what you think.
I think that's great. And the other thing that this is bringing up for me, and when I think about how do you make systems more efficient, do you talk with your network at all about cycle time, this idea of cycle time?
Why don't you go through it?
So cycle time is this idea that, you know, from the moment you start working on a piece of work to the moment it's done, and really you can trace that to it being billed and you collecting it, that's your cycle time.
Got it.
And so one of the things that is important to do, once you've sort of identified what you're going to charge for something, identified the kind of value or the average value, it is one of the things that you can do is try and reduce that cycle time as much as possible. And so, you know, just as an idea, and I don't know if this will land in your context, but, you know, have an accountant working on 10 returns at a time instead of 50 returns at a time, right? And then complete those 10 and then move on to the next 10. Because now what you're doing is you are reducing the context switching, reducing the kind of back and forth, reducing the waiting by email. And you can actually use this as, so, you know, if you're going to have an accountant do 100 returns or 50 returns in a season, you know, have all the 50 or the 100 returns queued up, but then only have them work on 10 at a time. And then you can even give clients heads up, like, hey, here's how we're going to be working on this. And now all of a sudden you just have all of these drives to efficiency. And also, now that you have a fixed price, you're well incentivized and you're capturing all that efficiency.
No, I like it. For example, we have a goal of a 3-week turnaround. So from the time the client brings the information in until we get the return out, 3 weeks. And because that would be your cycle time, right? So
right,
what's the cycle on this tax return? What's the cycle on that tax return? I love that. So as we're finishing up here, and we could go forever here, Chris, clearly, we may have to do this again sometime.
I love it.
But let me ask you one last thing, because I think it gets to this complexity issue. You bring up the idea of having too many experts, and I think of it in a way of analysis paralysis, which is a huge issue for accountants. How do you, just in a few minutes, can you give us some ideas of how you overcome that?
You know, one of the problems with having too many experts, particularly too many experts of the same kind, is that you just get into groupthink, right? You're not willing to say you don't know. You're not willing to question things. And you know, what that does in more complex environments, it means you're less likely to see opportunities, you're less likely to see challenges and threats, but it also means you just adopt the conventional wisdom. So if everybody you're talking with is an accountant and they're, you know, accountants, you're just going to do things the same way that they do. So I think there's just such value in kind of going after an injection of intellectual diversity. You know, talking about cycle time, there's a book that's not mine that I'll recommend to your listeners, which is called The Lean Law Firm. So different audience, but man, these guys are sharp. They've got a good podcast. I mean, I recommend it because I just see so many kind of so many crossovers. That's just an example. You want to be always working at the state of the art, and being surrounded by a bunch of experts that are just like you isn't helpful. So be in a network like yours, Tom. I mean, that's what I would say to people. People are on the fence about joining your network. Join Tom's network, right? Like, you're going to be around other people that are curious and want to learn, and you're going to be around Tom, who's thinking about this stuff in a way that is not conventional, not business as usual. And that's hugely important. I think that's a big chunk of the don't surround yourself by experts. That's that. If I were to give one takeaway from that, that would be it.
I love that. This has been outstanding. Chris Clearfield, the book is Meltdown. Chris, where can we get more of you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, Chris Clearfield, Twitter at Chris Clearfield. You can go to meltdownbook.net and you can download a free sample of the book. That also will get you to an opportunity to join my mailing list, where I write about change, personal development, transformation in this kind of professional context that we're talking about. So awesome. That might be interesting. And then, I look forward to staying in touch.
Awesome. Thank you, Chris. Just remember that, you know, this whole idea of complexity, I'm fascinated by this idea that that's where the failures come that we have a tough time getting past is when there's so much complexity, we can't even see what the failures are. We can't see the little failures. And
right.
And I love the idea of transparency. Transparency be the opposite of complexity. That seriously, I mean, you at least a dinner. You owe this reader.
Yeah, totally.
So I love that. I think that as CPAs, especially, we can be a lot more transparent with our clients, with our staff, and most of all with ourselves. And then when we do, I think we're always going to end up with better clients, better practice, and better life. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Wealthability for CPA show. Better clients, better practice, better life. To learn more, go to wealthability.com. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.